I'm not elusive. The only time when I don't like to give interviews is when I'm shooting. Because I'm not the kind of character, considering the kind of roles I play. You understand what I mean? Like, let's say Freud, or the Young Lions, or Judgment at Nuremberg, or From Here to Eternity. I can't suddenly throw up the mask and have lunch with somebody. It would take me another 3/4 of an hour to get back to the scene that was cut because of lunch.
Welcome back to Hollywood Declassified. I'm John William Law, your host. Thanks for tuning in. You were just listening to Montgomery Clift talk a little bit about his approach to work. We have some sound bites. Some of them we came up with or have from the enhanced edition of The Longest Suicide in Hollywood. So the podcast, this series, is talking about a book that I wrote, which is called The Longest Suicide in Hollywood, The Death of Montgomery Clift. And it is from Apollo Publishing. It is out wherever books are sold. It is available in a print copy as well as an ebook, and then, as I mentioned, an enhanced version, which is on iTunes iBookstore, has some added commentary from myself and from Montgomery Clift, in fact. So we have a few snippets of that. So we're adding in a few of those into the podcast too. This series takes some snippets from pieces of the book, and then I add some additional commentary around it. The book is obviously more substantial than this, so I'm focusing this series really on the car crash that nearly killed Montgomery Clift, and then the kind of events from that would he was making a film called Ranger County at the time. So I talk a bit about the movie here, and then we're going to talk a little bit here about the kind of add-on to follow up from the movie and where that would go, which is really where the bulk of the book faces or goes into. So if you're interested in learning more than what you get from this podcast, obviously go ahead and check out the book. Raintree County was, again, filmed in 1956. It was intended to be sort of MGM's hope to be another Gone with the Wind, which was really the idea there. It was, again, Gone with the Wind was in 1939, so you're talking about, 20 years later. A lot had changed in Hollywood. A lot had changed at MGM. Elizabeth Taylor at this point was really a big star. She was the draw. She actually was the driving force in getting the film off the ground. She was, as the star, she was also the driving force in getting Montgomery Clift signed on to the film as her leading man. And they had acted before together, so they had worked together in A Place in the Sun and had been a very successful teaming, and they actually became very good friends, and friends, in fact, that they would basically, the remainder of their lives, they would be very close. They would make another film together, which is after this movie, a couple years later, about 1959, which was called Suddenly Last Summer. And I talk about that one in the book as well. And then there was some other work that they continued to stay in touch and meet each other every now and then. I talk a little bit about that. And they were intending to work together one more time, but at the end of Montgomery Clift's life, that film that they would never complete together. And I talk about that in the book as well. So. But Ranger County was completed in 1956. It was very late. It took a lot longer, obviously, because they had weeks and, actually several months of downtime because of his Montgomery Clift recuperating from his injuries. And obviously the effort to film him even after he had returned to the set because of his injuries took longer than they expected. And there were a lot of challenges and a lot of delays. And then obviously the editing process takes a long time as well too, because they're looking at Montgomery Clift very carefully, looking at how he's being shot from the right side and making sure they can get interspersed the dialogue and the close-ups and all the other pieces to kind of make it work together. This sad thing or the ironic thing about Ranger County is that it's filmed with a kind of new film process, which was called Camera 65. And Camera 65 is something that you don't really hear about much. It was actually really not very used. But at the time, if you go back to the kind of 1950s, with the advent of television, movie studios were working very hard to make sure that they didn't lose their audience to TV. And so what happened was a lot of studios started coming up with these kind of unique film processes to try and draw people into the movie theater, because they wanted to give you an experience that you weren't going to get at home. And they were afraid that everyone would just abandon the movies and just stay at home and watch the box in their living room. So they came out with processes, and they came out with things like 3D, for instance, is one of those examples. And then you had other things like VistaVision and Panavision were other ones, and there would be some other ones later on as well. But there were many different film processes that you tried to do. CinemaScope, I'm trying to think of, surround sound came in a bit later, but there were a lot of these different processes that they developed these marketing campaigns around. And the idea was to take them, the movie, and make it actually larger than life. So they were trying to fit more on the screen and make the screen wider and more of a visual overload kind of experience for people. And so Camera 65 was the same thing. They took 70 millimeter cameras and they actually converted them to a 65 millimeter process, and they actually filmed it with these special types of lenses. And then the intention was to broadcast or actually present a larger screen view. So it was actually more like an epic. And again, if you think back to the 1950s, and even the 1960s, there were a lot of these big epic films. So things like Ben-Hur, War and Peace, Giant, another Elizabeth Taylor film. These films were very epic. And Rain Tree County was intended to be the same thing. So they released the film in Camera 65, and the irony of it, obviously, is that it made the image that much bigger, that much crisper, that much clearer. And so for Montgomery Clift, who had been in this horrible accident and was worried that his career was over because he'd been scarred and disfigured, that his visual, problems would be even that much more present for people to see. The reality was that wasn't really the case. And that was partly because, for several reasons. One, because again, they had shot him after the accident at a distance. So you really didn't get any real close-ups of Montgomery Clift in the film that are kind of post-crash, because he was shot from the right side. And they tried to use him at a distance shot, or they would insert a close-up from prior to that. So you really didn't get to see a lot of that. The other thing they said was that Montgomery Clift actually hadn't really been in a movie for 3 years. He had filmed From Here to Eternity in like 54 or so, 53, I guess he'd filmed it in that time frame. And he really didn't do another movie until, 1956. So, about 3 years or so had passed before he was before a movie screen and before audiences, because he'd actually filmed, From Here to Eternity even before it was released. So they said that those years were hard on him as well. So not only was it the crash that would impact him, but also he was already getting involved in heavy usage of alcohol and in various forms of drugs to kind of help him sleep and wake up and things like that. So there was actually a toll that had already been taken on his looks at that point. So even in the scenes where people thought that it was filmed after the crash versus scenes that they filmed before were actually really not that easy to tell, and people were sometimes wrong in those accounts. But nevertheless, it did kind of create this kind of draw in a way, and in fact, it was one of the reasons why when MGM did release the film, it actually did okay. Was not a huge success. It was not a Gone with the Wind, which made, somewhere $30 million or something. Rain Tree County made about $5 million, I think it was. And it was relatively panned by the critics. The performances were okay. There were people like Eva Marie Saint, who was applauded for her role. Elizabeth Taylor got some credit for her role. Rod Taylor was in the film. A number of other actors were in the film. That Agnes Moorehead, for instance. There were a bunch of different actors in the film that got relatively good reviews and credit for their work. And it was a period piece with a lot of costumes and a lot of beautiful scenery and kind of vast kind of, shots and kind of all of those things that actually made it an epic that gets some acclaim. But at the same time, it was considered a 3-hour bore. People were tired of it. They didn't think it was that interesting a story, and it didn't really capture the imagination. MGM had really taken out all the stops to really promote the film as well. They'd done a lot of other things. They had tried to put out, a book on the movie, and they had posters, and they had music, and they had cufflinks, and they had rain tree events, and they really were trying to kind of push this as being a Gone with the Wind, and the movie just really didn't hold up upon closer inspection. So it would sort of fade into Hollywood history, I guess you could say. It was not a memorable film, not nominated for much in the way of awards. Montgomery Clift was not really applauded for his performance. He was not slammed for it, but he did receive an award. I can't remember. It's in the book. And he received an honorary award from a Hollywood group for basically just the act of actually being able to return to the film and complete it for kind of a admiration of his work ethic kind of a thing. And he would get that, and that would be sort of the one thing that he would kind of get from the film that would be positive, I guess. After the film was over, there was, again, a gap of time before he would work again, and obviously there was a gap before the film was even released, so he was fortunate enough to try and line up another project. So before the film even came out, he had actually lined up this next project, and he would do another film after this, and the film that would come out after Ranger County that starred him would be a movie called The Young Lions, and The Young Lions was a very good film. It is a really, really good film, and he's really good at it. But again, Montgomery Clift at this point, he had believed his career was over. He thought his looks were gone. But at the same time, the one thing that he did sort of recognize is that his entire career up until that point really was, a lot of it was based around his looks. He was considered a heartthrob. He was considered a draw because he was this handsome, good-looking man, and that was why people wanted to see him on the movie screen and hire him. The fact that he was a good actor added to it, but he had fan clubs of adoring, you know, young girls who were following him around trying to kind of, you know, be in his presence type of thing. And so he sort of had this opportunity with the accident to sort of move away from that, to say, okay, I'm not going to be just about my looks. And so doing something like The Young Lions was, again, another kind of return to a war picture, but it had a good amount of romance in it. It was a good character film for him. He starred alongside Dean Martin and Marlon Brando, both of whom would become friends of his. Marlon Brando and he had been friends actually way back to the Actor's Studio, and Marlon Brando had, and I talk about this in the books in a bit, that Marlon Brando was one of the people who knew that Monty was actually having real trouble. He was actually, because of the drugs and the alcohol that were making it really difficult for him to function and live and work, he really was one of the people who really stepped out and said, I really want to help you. Montgomery Clift, in all of the people that tried to help him over the years, never accepted help. The Young Lions would be one of his favorite roles. He really felt he did a great job in it and really enjoyed the work, the project. He did enjoy working with Marlon Brando. They two had been very much friends and fans of each other's work. Interestingly enough, though, when you see The Young Lions, they actually never appear on screen together, never act together. They actually only time is at the very, very end of the movie when Marlon Brando's character dies. I hate to be a spoiler, but there is a scene of him standing over his body, I guess you could say. That's the only time they were actually in the scene together, but they actually never worked or had dialogue together. After The Young Lions, he would move on to another film, and that would be called Lonely Hearts. Lonely Hearts is a small picture that was done in the latter part of the 1950s. Again, he sort of returned to that of kind of a leading man in a kind of romanticized hero type role, I guess you could say. And the movie, something that shows that he had the ability to kind of to take on that leading man, you know, kind of romantic hero type of role even after the crash. And he sort of realized that he actually can work. He could actually have a career after the crash. And now Ranger County had come out, Young Lions had been done, and he was doing this film, and he was sort of, you know, it was not over for him. So that was sort of a good thing. But at the same time, his use of drugs and alcohol continued to this point, and it did make it very difficult for him to get work, let alone to get good work. So this was a small film, not paid a lot of money for it, but he did star opposite Myrna Loy and Robert Taylor. After that film, he would do Suddenly Last Summer, which I mentioned already, which was another opportunity to star opposite Elizabeth Taylor. She, again, was instrumental in getting in the role. She sort of put up her salary as a kind of collateral to make sure that he would do the film. She felt, she convinced the producers that she could help him get a performance out of him. She would pay for his insurance to make sure that he did the film. She believed in the project and in working with him. And that is quite an interesting role. I don't know that his performance is anything dramatic or special to the film that he brings to it, but he plays a psychiatrist who is there to kind of evaluate Elizabeth Taylor. She has been involved in some tragic event at the very beginning of the movie with the death of her cousin, and they don't really know why. And so her aunt, which is who is played by Katharine Hepburn, wants to erase this tragic event from Elizabeth Taylor's mind by forcing her to have a lobotomy. Montgomery Clift's character is brought in to evaluate her to decide if that is the best course of action. And Katharine Hepburn's character is offering the hospital where Elizabeth Taylor is a vast sum of money to build a new wing if they complete the surgery. So Montgomery Clift is sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place here, and he helps uncover this, you know, story of an interesting story of kind of homosexuality and deep secrets in the film. He would follow this film again. It was a tough film for him to make, and it was a successful film. So it was probably one of the most successful films that he would make in his latter career, I would guess you'd say, possibly the most successful film that he made after the accident. He would continue again working. He did his best probably in small roles after this. He did do a couple of other kind of big starring roles. One film that he did after this was called Wild River, and it was directed by Elia Kazan and co-starred Lee Remick. I'm not going to talk about too much about it. I do write about it in the book. It was, again, it was a chance for him to star in a film, but it was not a huge success. Released around 1960, in fact, around the time that Psycho came out, didn't get a whole lot of play at the movies, and not really a great lot of critical success with the film either, but an interesting film nonetheless. After that, he would work with Marilyn Monroe, Thelma Ritter, and Clark Gable in The Misfits, which was a good film for him. Again, he had a very small role, and the supporting role was one of the things that he did really well at this time, because of his drug and alcohol use, and something I go into more detail in the book. It really, the shorter roles where he wasn't as engaged as much or didn't have as much pressure on him, where he was able to kind of perform better and deliver more effective performances, whereas films where he was starring in the entire film, people felt it was much more difficult to get a full kind of a full performance out of him for those. So The Misfits would be one of the opportunities for him to shine, although The Misfits was very troubled, obviously, because Marilyn Monroe was sort of in the same boat as Montgomery Clift because of her own drug and alcohol issues and the fact that she, in a starring role, it was very hard to get a performance out of her. They would both be directed by John Huston in that film. And Huston would return again a couple times in Montgomery Clift's life. But the next film he would make after that would be another kind of small cameo role, which was riveting. It was in the movie Judgment at Nuremberg. And Judgment at Nuremberg was released in 1961. Montgomery Clift has a very short scene. I think he's on screen for probably about 6 minutes. He was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for this short performance. He plays a victim of the Nazis in World War II in Germany, and he has been castrated, I guess is the best way to put it, and he's called in to testify against the men who were on trial for crimes against humanity, basically. Spencer Tracy plays the judge, and Montgomery Clift agreed. He was actually offered one of the bigger roles in the film, the role that Richard Widmark plays in one of the lawyer roles, but he didn't want to do the role. I believe that it was suspected that he felt that that it was too much. He was not going to be able to hold up for the entire film, and so he wanted to do something in the film, though, and he opted to do a small cameo, accepted one of these small parts. And he actually took the film for nothing. He was paid no salary. He opted to do the film for nothing because he felt that if he charged a fee for it, even if it was a reduced fee, it would sort of ruin the opportunity itself. And he really didn't want to take a huge salary for such a small part. So he ended up agreeing to do it for nothing. Stanley Kramer pulled out a really, really great movie. It's a long movie, but it is a fantastic movie. Got some really great performances from some of the top actors of their day. Judy Garland would also be in a small cameo. She would also be nominated for an Academy Award. Spencer Tracy did fantastic. Maximilian Schell won an Academy Award for it. Burt Lancaster is in the film. Richard Widmark, as I mentioned, Marlena Dietrich. Really, really good film. And great to see Montgomery Clift do the film, because had he lived, I think that movie really did kind of articulate the types of things that he would do really well, which would be these smart kind of character-driven parts. But he would not do that. In fact, his next film would be a return to a large film that he would star in, which was called Freud, which was directed by John Huston, and it was a debacle. It was not a successful film. The Montgomery Clift's performance was a strong one, a good one in some respects, but at the same time, because he was in the entire film, it was very difficult for it to get made. It was very difficult for John Huston. He had a hard time. He believed in Montgomery Clift because he'd worked with him in The Misfits, and he felt that he could get a performance out of him, that he believed that The Misfits showed that he still had the ability to produce, you know, really good work. The problem was that The Misfits was a really small part, and Freud was the entire film. And so the two would not get along well in the film. It would be very difficult. There would be a lot of legal issues and lawsuits. Montgomery Clift was also plagued with a number of issues, including cataracts at the time, which made it very difficult for him to see and read his script. But it was not a happy experience for anyone involved, I believe, and it was not a successful film. Although Montgomery Clift really believed in the role and really hoped that he would at last get nominated for an Academy Award, but the film was pretty much a failure at the box office and did very little in the way of acclaim. But Montgomery Clift went into kind of a difficult time at this period because of the lawsuits and the issues surrounding Freud. It made him very hard for him to get work. So he spent the next few years really kind of looking at scripts and in fact, turning down films. He had a number of film offers that were offered to him, but he felt a lot of them that were offered were beneath him. And he just kind of hung out in New York. He had a home in New York, and he was living there and sort of waiting for the right role, I guess. And he did run into Elizabeth Taylor at the time. She was in New York with her husband at the time, Richard Burton. He was appearing on stage in Hamlet, I believe. And they invited him to the premiere, and they went and got together, and they had dinner several times. And they started talking about the idea of working together in a film. And one of the films that was suggested was a movie called Reflections in a Golden Eye. And Reflections in a Golden Eye, I talk about it in the book. I actually recorded some additional commentary in the book, in the enhanced edition, where I talk about Reflections in the Golden Eye in a little more detail, because I don't go into a huge amount of detail in the book, partly because Montgomery Clift never finished the film, or never made the film, never appeared in it. In fact, Marlon Brando would actually take the role. Montgomery Clift would be dead before the production would begin. Partly because Elizabeth Taylor had a number of other projects to make. She was assigned to things like The Sandpipers and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and so she wasn't available, so they had to wait. And during the time that they were waiting, Montgomery Clift would agree to do one more film. He did a little movie that was called The Defector, and The Defector was a kind of espionage film that was from a kind of unknown director, a European film. He went to Munich to film it. And he did it in part because he wanted to prove to himself and to Elizabeth Taylor and to the powers at in Hollywood that he could actually make a film, still was capable of working, to prove that to them and everyone that he still had what it took to get Reflections in a Golden Eye, in fact. So he would do The Defector. It would be the last film he completed. He actually died before it was released, so it would ultimately be released after his death. It did not do well. It is an interesting film in the fact that it is his last film, and you can see how unhealthy and how terrible he looks. He was 45 years old at the time, and he looked much older. It is a very strange film in a way, but it is does mark, in fact, his last big screen appearance, and so for that, it is kind of a relevant or interesting film. But he would die in July of 1966 at his home of what the coroner called a heart attack brought on by occlusive coronary artery disease. They had noted in his autopsy that that obviously years of drug and alcohol abuse had taken a toll. He had a whole host of medical issues that had been plaguing him for the last, 10 years. And that's why many people said that his death was really brought on by his own hand, by all of the behaviors and the things that he did to really basically kill himself, to kill his body. And so he died in the summer, and they found him in the next morning. In fact, he had a live-in kind of caretaker, I guess you could say, a sort of not really a nurse, but a companion that they had hired to kind of help him in his last couple of years, to kind of be with him and make sure that he kind of stayed on path. And his caretaker was a guy by the name of Lorenzo James, and James had seen him the night before, not really talked to him at all during the day, and then the night before he kind of went up at, like, I think it was around 1 a.m. in the morning or something, or right before that, and to check in on him, and he was fine. He was sitting in bed reading, and he asked him if he wanted to watch The Misfits, in fact, because James had said that he had saw that it was on The Late Late Show, and the last words that Montgomery Clift said was, absolutely not. And so he would find him the next day when he tried to get into the room. He couldn't get into the room, so he had to go downstairs and run around the house and climb a ladder and kind of come in through the bedroom window and find his body there. And so after that, news broke, and, Hollywood, people noted, and many people kind of, some people attended the funeral, some of his close friends, people like Elizabeth Taylor, Frank Sinatra, were not able to make it there in time. He was buried in New York, and so they sent flowers, but he had a small kind of funeral, and he was buried in New York, and his legacy sort of lives on. And so I talk a little bit about that in the kind of last kind of chapter or so of the book, about what legacy he left behind, and the sad reality of the situation for Montgomery Clift was that he really did have a lot left to give and a lot left for him had he been able to take care of himself. And so there's a lot of interesting kind of speculation in terms of what his life was like and the decisions that he made and what took him down those paths and why he didn't kind of achieve the success that he wanted or whatever. And so I talk a little bit about those in the book again. And in the enhanced edition, I do offer some additional commentary here and there. So that is going to wrap up this series, I think, unless something else comes up that we decide to drop in. We will kind of be wrapping it up here. But again, if you're interested more in learning about Montgomery Clift and his life and career, you can get a copy of the book, The Longest Suicide in Hollywood, The Death of Montgomery Clift, wherever books are sold, published by Palm Publishing, released in July of 2001. Again, in a print, ebook, and enhanced editions on iTunes, bookstore, Amazon. You can get the print and ebook copies as well. So thanks for checking us out. Thanks for listening in to all of this. And hopefully we'll be back with another series of Hollywood Declassified soon. I actually have some recorded, so we've juggled things around. So there are a few that are kind of in the can, so to speak, that we'll be prepping for kind of for a future show. So thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time.